It is 3:16 on Thursday, February 22nd in Capitol Room 106. This meeting of the House Health and Social Services Committee and will now come to order. Members present are Representative Sullivan Leonard, Representative Tarr, Representative Johnston, and myself, Representative Sponholz. We have a quorum to conduct business now. If you are joining us in the room, make sure you've turned your cell phone off for the duration of the meeting. Thank you. Before we begin, I want to thank Butch Carver, the House HES Secretary for Records, and Madison Truitt from the Juno LIO for staffing the committee today. We have one bill that we're hearing today. It's House Bill 268 by Representative Les Guerra. It's dealing with opioid prescription information. We'll be hearing from the bill sponsor, taking public testimony, and then setting aside the bill for next Tuesday's meeting. Would Representative Guerra and Claire Gross, please come forward and present the bill? We do have one formality. I believe that we have a proposed committee substitute that we need to bring before the committee.
Madam Chair, I move that the Health and Social Services Committee adopt the blank committee substitute for House Bill 268, its work order number 30-LS1081/R, as a working document.
All right, I'm going to object for the purposes of conversation. Representative Guerra, would you put yourself on the record and walk us through the bill and then the changes in the CS?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Representative Les Guerra, District 20, and my aide, Claire Gross, who's worked on this bill with me. We made two major changes just to make the bill, sort of relax the bill, the requirements on providers. On page 4, lines 3 through 5, we wanted to make sure this bill only applied to outpatient prescriptions, not treatment within a facility, which would be very difficult to decide who in a facility should be read a warning, who shouldn't. And so this is really just a bill that applies to outpatients. The term outpatient supply comes from the last opioid bill that we passed, and there's a memo from Ledge Legal saying that term is well understood and doesn't have to be defined again. We made that change on page 4, lines 3 through 5, but then for every single one of the other professions, too, who are all regulated with the same exact language. The other change in section 4, on page 4, lines 20 and 21, the big change there is, again, to lower the burden on the prescribers. We originally had them discuss the link between opioid addiction and then the potential lead there to heroin use, and we thought that would get too complex in a short conversation, possibly too scary, and that's better for the handout if the department decides to put that in there. And then we changed the word health danger, which is scarier, to health risks, which is just as accurate, but we're trying not to use scary words. And we made the same change for each of the professions. So in the end, the verbal information given to the patient will be, are there reasonable alternatives in the prescriber's mind to the opioid, and just warn that there's a risk of addiction for prolonged use, and that's basically the verbal warning. And then the written document will be provided. The Department of Health and Social Services will be required to put something online that can be easily printed out of a prescriber's office and handed out.
All right, thank you. Are there any questions for Representative Guerra? All right, proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Make sure I can operate this. So I'm not going to read everything in this PowerPoint. Some of these documents come straight off the Department of Health and Social Services website. We've worked with Dr. Butler and some others to come up with the most instructive things. Roughly 14,000 people die a year from prescription opioid use or misuse. That's about 91 Americans a day. Since 1999, the use of opioid prescriptions on a per capita basis has tripled, and then as many as one in four people receiving a prescription for opioids long-term in a primary care setting ends up struggling with addiction. That's not one in four people prescribed, but over the long term. And for Alaska, what we know is that the opioid death rate is twice the national average on a per capita basis, And the heroin-associated overdose or overuse death rate in Alaska is 50% higher than nationally. So it all goes down to what everybody knows, which is opioid use and heroin use. It's a crisis in the United States, in Alaska, and frankly, worldwide. This folks might remember from the bigger opioid bill the governor had years ago, but basically the longer you use an opioid, the longer you're prescribed an opioid and use it, the higher the chance of long-term dependence and then ultimately possibly addiction. And that jump starts at 3 and 5 days and 20 days and continues. The statistic that I find most interesting here, or scary here, is the last one. Of people who end up becoming heroin users, roughly 80%, some say 75%, start out using opioid and other pain-killing prescriptions. Now, that doesn't mean that 80% of people who start using opioids become heroin addicts, but of the people who become heroin addicts, they started on painkillers and especially opioid prescriptions. It's another way of saying it's dangerous. This comes straight out of the bill. This is what the bill does, the CS that is before the committee. This is what the licensee, the prescriber, has to do, and it applies to all the medical professionals who prescribe and who have the ability to prescribe these drugs. Same exact language for each one of them, but before supplying it, she'll provide to the patient or person authorized to make the healthcare decisions an oral statement in the provider's own words, and we discussed that. We want to do it in the provider's own words so they don't have to read a script, so they don't have to memorize anything, so they don't become robots, so they remain providers in their own words. The reasons for prescribing it, most likely it's going to be pain reduction. Any reasonable alternatives to the prescription, if the provider feels there are, and then information that that the danger of opioid addiction can begin to increase if a prescription is extended over longer periods of time, and that opioid addiction may be potentially life-threatening. We wanted to not interfere with the patient-provider relationship, so we were very clear in the bill that there's no civil liability for violating this bill. We don't want to create sort of a lawsuit-happy environment out of this bill, so this bill doesn't create a cause of action. And we also want to make sure prescribers are allowed the right to make honest mistakes in perhaps not following the dictates of this bill every single time. Maybe they don't have the paper to print out the Department of Health and Social Services warning. Maybe they just forget. Maybe they just had a busy day. There is an enforcement mechanism. The boards for each of these professions always have the discretion to impose sanctions and the discretion not to for violation. That's up to the board. But we say that they should only be given the discretion where the prescriber habitually violates the law. So basically turns their head away from the law and doesn't apply the law. And where there's if they had good cause for their violation, that's fine. And there's no penalty if you had good cause. You had no paper in your printer. You had a busy day. But really the big thing that's going to prevent really many board enforcement actions is the violation has to be habitual before the board can say you violated it. Again, to protect the patient-provider relationship. The written statement is really, that's going to be something the Department of Health and Social Services is eager to and will put online, so a provider can then just print it off a website. And so that's the written part, and we will leave that up to the department to decide what information to provide. If you provide 30 pages of information, they know nobody's going to read it. But we feel comfortable that they know with some graphics, if they wish, to provide a short statement that shows people the potential risks. So the question is, why are we doing this? We know about the dangers of opioids. And the CDC realizes and knows that not all providers tell people about the dangers of opioids. This is an information bill. This is a full disclosure bill to patients. The medical community has not always told patients about the dangers of opioids. In my own example, I've probably been prescribed them a half dozen times, maybe 3 years ago for broken ribs. And I understand why. This information is just becoming familiar to people. But I've never been warned of the dangers of opioid use. I'm sure I have on paper. the piece of paper that you don't ever read that you get with your prescription, or that I don't ever read. That's maybe my problem. And then in speaking to people, and that's where it came from, in speaking to people, I was also told similar experiences. It's just not something that has been commonly discussed when people receive opioid prescriptions. If your physician is already doing this, then there's nothing in this bill that's going to change their practice. But if your physician is not, then they should. And so the CDC guideline has been issued because the CDC is aware that this really isn't happening on a regular basis in all prescriber offices. And so the CDC guideline is voluntary, but basically it says talk about alternatives. It says talk about dangers. And it's actually much more comprehensive than the bill if provider decides to follow all the CDC guidelines, which we hope they would.
We have a question from Representative Johnson.
Yes, thank you to the chair. How are you going to get the word out about this, or how are you going to make this effective?
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Johnston. By regulating, the way the bill just had to be written is you had to write it through each of the board mechanisms for each profession. Once this bill passes, if the board doesn't know the bill has passed, that would be pretty surprising. So the board should certainly tell its members. We passed an opioid bill 2 years ago. Word got out very quickly about that bill's requirements. I don't personally have a worry about the word getting out, but if I don't know. I didn't have any worry about it.
The only reason I bring this up is I was in one of the clinics this year, and it was after Anchorage had their, and I really like Anchorage's answer to
price estimate, closure. Good faith estimate.
Yes, mm-hmm. And the office didn't have the little sign, and they were very unaware of it. And in fact, a couple offices I went into. So I'm just I'm not asking to be a pill. I'm asking as far as how you really see you getting this out.
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, I think it's a fair question. I don't particularly have a concern, but if we had a concern, we could have an amendment that asked the boards to notify its members, and that would probably be an easy, cheap way that boards could do by electronic means.
There is typically there are professional organizations for each of these healthcare providers, and they're watching the legislature pretty closely. They're not always watching the municipality quite as closely. They're not typically regulated by the municipality in the same kinds of ways that we're describing here. But so the State Medical Association, for example, or the optometrists, they have lobbyists each that watch what's happening and are tracking these kinds of things. I don't think we'll see the same kind of communication gap.
And thank you, through the chair. And then the last thing on the CDC guidelines, I don't even want to play a doctor on TV. So we made sure that the requirements in the bill that are mandatory are lesser than the requirements than the CDC guidelines, which we hope providers will follow but can't make providers follow. So we don't have anything more stringent than the CDC has recommended. And the CDC got involved in part because of what I said, but in part because it's an epidemic. And I think addressing the epidemic is going to be one of these things where there's no one solution. I'm not going to say that this will end the opioid epidemic at all, but you do need informed patients and informed parents to know about it if their children are prescribed these drugs. So informed parents can watch their children's use of these prescriptions, and so people can take personal responsibility and monitor themselves so they know whether or not they feel like they're in danger as well. With that, I don't think that there's not much more I need to add. It's really just a two-part bill, the written statement and the, in their own words, prescriber statement.
Is there any other questions from the committee? All right, Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Guerra, I'm looking through the bill and was trying to see, is there an area where you would have something posted in a conspicuous place with regard to notification, kind of like what the CDC just had up there regarding opioid? Is there a mandate now that must be posted in each office, or or is this bill kind of reinforcing that? It should be posted, or just a pamphlet giving to a patient?
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, good question, and it's something that we had thought about. We don't want to overregulate, so you'll get the verbal statement is the most important because people don't often always read what they're given. The verbal statement will be very short. It'll just alert the patient, and then they'll be given a handout. So we thought about posting, and then we decided you're getting a handout, you're getting a verbal statement. There doesn't have to be another posting on a wall. So that was our opinion, that would be overregulating. So we don't require posting anywhere.
Follow up. And again, then, so how do you follow up with oversight then for the different physicians' offices? Do they have a checklist of patients that they see every day and they say, I told this person, that person, that they received this information, and then they turn that information into the Alaska Medical Board, or kind of where does this go?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, we don't mandate that on providers. If they feel like keeping a record to protect themselves, they could keep a record, but there's no liability. I don't think they'll be worried about liability. So I think they'll give the short verbal statement, conversation with the patient. If the patient wants to have the conversation, they'll hand out the information. I think that'll be the end of it. If a doctor feels like, or any prescriber feels like keeping a record of it, they could, but there's no requirement that they do that.
Okay, and then follow up, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. So when you talk about habitual offenders, are we talking about then those patients that have obtained opioids from a particular physician or dentist, not illegally, but continually without oversight, or how do we process that part?
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, I have a habit of sometimes going through these things a little bit more quickly than I should. The habitual part has nothing to do with the patient. The habitual language is used to say, we're not going to punish a doctor in front of a doctor or a dentist or a nurse practitioner, the medical professionals who are allowed to prescribe. Don't worry about punishment before your board unless you habitually decide you're just not going to follow the law. And so that's the only circumstance where the board would have any enforcement authority over you. Otherwise, we're not going to oversee providers. We're not going to have people show up at their offices to see what they're doing. It's going to be the rare provider, if any, that's going to purposely violate this law all the time.
Okay.
So it's the provider. As long as they don't habitually violate the law, there's no worry about board sanctions.
Okay. Thanks.
So I kind of have a follow-up to that, Representative Garrett. So you're presuming then that primarily enforcement would take place through boards, that people, in theory, patients who hadn't been notified of their, you know, of the risks of taking an opioid could make a complaint to the board which oversees the profession. So if it's a general practitioner, I'm going to see my general practitioner. I don't get information told to me when I'm being prescribed an opioid. I become addicted. I'm upset about this. I could make a complaint to, say, the State Board of Medicine. And if there were numerous complaints, that's the point at which the board would step in.
Through the chair, that's correct. And if there's one complaint, I guess they could follow up. But if the prescriber says, you know, I just forgot that day, there's no sanction. If there's a ton of complaints about the one provider, I think the board will, or a bunch of complaints, the board will take more notice and really quiz the provider whether they're giving the information out at all.
Okay. Yeah, Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, through the chair. So this prompts another question. Is the medical board for the state then receiving a lot of complaints at this juncture about physicians that are overprescribing opioids and then not receiving information that this is addictive?
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, we know from the CDC's action and then just anecdotally from speaking to people and frankly from speaking to some providers, that this information is not always given. We want it to be given. Whether the failure to provide this information has statistically led to a higher incidence of opioid addiction, I can't tell you for sure. What I can tell you is when human beings are given information, they often appreciate it and act on it, and in this case, hopefully protect themselves.
I'm noting, too, that we have in the room Sarah Chambers, who works with boards and commissions, who can probably describe a little bit more detail and public testimony, perhaps, that process that would be used in this. I think we're all very curious about it. But we have a little bit of a housekeeping before we can move over to public testimony, and that is that I have continued to have an objection to this CS for the purposes of conversation. I'm going to withdraw my objection. Is there any further objection to adopting the CS? All right, seeing none, we've adopted it. And then we'll go ahead and open this up to public testimony. The first person I want to call actually is on the phone, and that's Physician Ann Zink, and she's in the ER in Palmer, and so I'd like to call her first just so she can get back to work.
Thank you so much, Representative. I really appreciate you taking my testimony today. So I am Ann Zink, an emergency physician at Matsu Regional out here in Palmer, Alaska. And today I'm speaking on behalf of the American College of Emergency Physicians Alaska chapter. So we represent about 80% of the emergency physicians in the state of Alaska. And the testimony provided in your packet was vetted through our board and through our larger emergency medicine colleagues. We really do see the best and worst of opiates in the emergency department. It's an amazing pain reliever when people have metastatic disease, bad fractures, but we've also been seeing how opiates have really wrecked the lives of so many patients, and overdoses and violent threats towards physicians, staff, and other patients, and how it can just destroy lives. And as a result, we really feel like there needs to be more of a role that we're all playing in that. We've worked hard with the state to create opiate guidelines from the emergency department, which I believe are also in your packet. And we've been working with the department to create an opiate education, much in line with this bill, so that we can really be making sure that every time anyone is in the emergency department or any sort of medical encounter, they're getting information about the risk of these medications so they can make well-defined plans. In general, physicians, we really bristle or get hesitant about the idea of legislation when it comes in between us and the relationship with our patients. But we have seen many cases where patients didn't realize that they were addicted to opiates or that they'd been prescribed opiates because their physician had never explained those risk benefits to them. And that always provides concern for us. And we do think that this is a huge epidemic that needs to be fought kind of from every battleground in every way that we can do that. From our reading of HB 268, it really appears this legislation is asking us to do something that physicians should be doing for patients as a whole, having that conversation. And really educating them to non-opiate alternatives, if at all possible. And hopefully this could be sunsetted at some time when we no longer have this or pass this crisis. We're happy to play a role in whatever way we can, and we all play a role in helping to end this opiate crisis, and appreciate all of your time considering this as well as other bills to help to end the opiate crisis. And I'm happy to take any questions. So thank you.
Is there any questions for Dr. Zink? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. thank you, Dr. Zink. Really appreciate your testimony. it piqued my interest when you said that you've been working really hard with the department on opioid prescribing guidelines for emergency room departments. Mm-hmm. And I just wondered if you could give us a little, window into what that looks like and you know, how this might be complementary to that.
Yes, thank you so much to the chair. This is a fantastic question. Kind of makes my heart sing to hear you ask it. So we, through SB 74, 2 years ago, the Medicaid redesign bill, we inserted in a program there, this kind of ED frequent utilization program, but part of that included making opiate guidelines from the emergency department. And so we have, 2 Februarys ago, we sat down, we had numerous town hall meetings with emergency physicians, really went through the CDC guidelines, said what's making sense, what's not making sense. And out of that, we came with opiate guidelines from the emergency department following the CDC recommendations. We passed it to every major hospital in the state. The hospitals were all kind enough to put their logos on the back of it. And since then, we've been using a handout that we hand out to patients on a regular basis. Honestly, it's transformed much of the conversation that we've been having in the emergency department. We joke that there's kind of BD and AD before Dreamland or after Dreamland, a book by Sam Quintino who really talks about opiate epidemic. The amount of opiates that are written out of the emergency department in Alaska right now, I think, are dramatically less than had been previously, and part of that has been having these guidelines. We've been trying to work with the state to kind of get better data on what exactly that looks like, but having those guidelines has been really helpful. It's made us more on the same page that we're able to provide consistent care that doesn't involve opiates if it cannot, although sometimes we do need to use them, and that's okay, but trying to provide really consistent work. And then we've been working with the department to develop a handout just educating about opiates and non-opiate alternatives. So that's being tested in Fairbanks right now. We've all screened it, love it, and I can't wait to start handing it out to patients. So I'm hoping we can have similar guidelines from other specialties, but the emergency department has been very helpful, and we've seen a real clinical decrease in opiates at the emergency department. And honestly, better patient as well as physician satisfaction. It feels like a different place to work here than it did 5 years ago.
Wow, thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and thank you to you, Ms. Zink, Dr. Zink, for all of your work that you've been doing on the ED Super Utilizers Project. That's a really important project. We were happy to hear from you about it this last year, and perhaps we'll look forward to an update in the future.
Yes, thank you very much. We're really excited by it, and there's been a lot more that's happened in the next year, so looking forward to an update.
All right, super. Thank you, and have a great day.
Thanks, you too. Appreciate your time.
All right. So I want to just let members of the committee know that we have a few people in the room that are here for questions, and then I'll start pulling in the rest of the public testimony. We have Sarah Chambers, as I mentioned, Deputy Director, Division of Corporations, who works with the boards and commissions. We have Gail Bernth on the phone with the Department of Commerce and Community and Economic Development. We have Elena Habib from the Office of Substance Misuse and Addiction Prevention. And that looks like about it for right now. So we have a few resources on the phone and in the room as well. So is Shields Jorgensen in the room? Hi. And Shields has a. Is it Shalise?
It's Shalise.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's entered in wrong. I apologize.
It's okay. So I lost my voice yesterday. I'm going to try to get through this. But, so my name is Shalise Jorgensen. I am a medical director of a community health center, a federally qualified health center in Talkeena and Willow. We serve about 6,500 community members as the primary medical, behavioral, and dental health care in our area. We actually only have one other provider in about a 12,000 square mile zone. So we have five primary care providers, two dentists, all of which are prescribers. We have three providers who are DEAX certified, meaning they can prescribe medication-assisted treatment with buprenorphine for opiate addiction. And we've also had an outpatient-based opiate addiction program in place for about 8.5 years. So we know a lot about this issue. We spend a lot of time on it. And I want to talk just very briefly about some of the things that we do, because I think it's important to kind of understand all of the things that can be done in a primary care setting in particular. So for patients who come in and have pain issues, we universally screen them for depression and anxiety. We universally screen them for alcohol or other substance use. We require that they meet with a behavioral health provider. We use a standardized opiate risk assessment tool and standardized pain scales on every visit basis. We do random urine drug screening. We use the Alaska Prescription Drug Monitoring Program for every controlled substance prescription we write. We have controlled substance contracts. We have written procedures in place that all of our providers are to follow. We also dispense nasal Narcan and write prescriptions for nasal Narcan. And we counsel our patients universally on risk and benefits of any medication, but certainly any opiate medication. We also counsel on alternative treatments and therapies. Thank you. It hasn't helped yet to have water, but I appreciate it.
We try.
I appreciate it. Anyway, we also include pain management in our peer review process. So we're reviewing every single month what our providers are doing about this, how they're prescribing. And we also are participating in the drug take back program. So we have, twice a year someone come up and take, troopers come back to take medications back from the community. Mm-hmm. And we're about to have kiosk in both of our sites for that as well. So I review those because those are best practices around prescribing opiates. It's not a simple issue. And as a healthcare provider, I can tell you that the patient in pain wants information about what is the best course of treatment for their particular problem that will relieve their suffering with the lowest risk. They want a thoughtful evaluation, and they want a thought-out conversation with their provider about what's best. They are appreciative when we give them information that tells them that when you prescribe long-term opiates, they actually may have worse pain control in the long run. Mm-hmm. And they're appreciative when we tell them they may be at higher risk of addiction if they've had a family member who had addiction issues. Mm-hmm. I fully support this bill. I think that, again, it's one piece of it, but for some providers, they can't do the rest. And at least this holds providers to a minimum level of accountability to have a conversation with their patient, because that's what patients want, is they want their provider to have a conversation with them about whether this is the best treatment for what's going on for them in the moment. So like I said, a long story, make it shorter. I do support this legislation. And I would also hope that as this continues to move forward, that we look at the broader context with which we provide this type of care and how we educate providers, what mandates we could put in place to require education for providers if they are going to prescribe opiates.
All right. Thank you. Is there any questions for Dr. Jorgensen?
I'm not a medical doctor. I am a doctor in a nursing practice.
Okay. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just in the context of all these other communications you are having with patients, it sounds like, this isn't going to be onerous. You're, already taking advantage of those opportunities, and this would just be, another piece to add to that.
It would complement our practice. And we do most of this work already, but absolutely. I think there's really solid research out there that shows, even when you don't have the time to have a conversation, that when you can give written information, people about 25% of the time, but that's better than none, will look at that piece of paper later and get something from it. So even for a very busy practice that just doesn't have the time to do the rest, it can be helpful.
All right. Thank you very much. You made it. You were great. All right. Allison Kulis, did you want to give some testimony? All right. Come on forward.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Allison Kulas, and I am the executive director of the Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse and the Alaska Mental Health Board. And our boards have submitted a letter of support for HB 268, an act relating to the prescription of opioids. In addition, we also have another board member, Gunnar Ebsen, who submitted a letter from Turning Point Counseling, which is in Fairbanks. And Gunnar was unable to make the public testimony today, but does definitely send his support as well. The boards were an integral part in the Alaska Opioid Policy Task Force, which put together that really broad set of recommendations to prevent, treat, and support recovery from opioid misuse in Alaska. And one piece of these recommendations was to address the prescribing practices related to pain management and opioid medications. we believe opioid prescribers should talk to their patients about potential addictive qualities of opioids and discuss other treatment options while following those state prescribing guidelines. Because of the addictive nature of these drugs, we also support providers working with patients in a type of exit plan as they're prescribing to really discuss with the patient of how they can safely stop using the opioids without starting a dependence. We are aware that the Department of Health and Social Services is developing patient information brochures and other education, and we fully support the distribution of these materials when prescribing opioids. Taken together, we really believe that patients will be able to make informed choices about their health care. We appreciate the hope to keep the requirements flexible and as non-burdensome as possible. Like Representative Guerra mentioned, this should be happening anyhow, but we've heard that it's really unfortunately necessary for further patient protections. HB 268 is one piece of that puzzle to turn the tide on opioid addiction. And we hope to work with the licensing boards to really ensure that the right groups are addressing the issue effectively. We look forward to working with you on this and any other solutions to the opioid epidemic. Thank you for your time and hearing HB 268, and please let us know if you have any additional questions.
Are there any questions for Ms. Kulas? Did I say it correctly this time?
Yes. Kulas? Thank you.
All right, seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. And with this, I think I want to ask Sarah Chambers to come up and address the question that came up earlier, if you would, the way that boards will engage with this process. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Chambers. I'm the Deputy Director of the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. And I'm happy to answer any questions in addition to the one that's currently on the table. As I understand, the question is how will this be enforced? What would be the mechanism that boards would use to act upon a complaint? And our investigative process, which is in place for all of our 43 of our licensing programs, would include an intake process. So our investigators would intake a complaint, and the complaint could be, as was presented in the hypothetical, that I'm suffering or my loved one is suffering and we think it started here and we didn't get properly informed when my child, let's say, was prescribed an opioid. We were not verbally told, we were not handed the piece of paper. And so our investigators would look into that, would talk to the provider, would look at the patient record to determine whether the notes showed that that person did verbally provide that warning and did hand out the piece of paper that's required. In the absence of those patient notes, then it could be assumed that that didn't happen, especially if it's a mandate of law that they have to provide that. The threshold that's set in the bill is that the infraction, in order for a board to take action, the infraction has to be habitual and without good cause. And the legislative legal analysis defines habitual as customary or usual. So that sets a bar, as the sponsor explained, that more than just this person's medical records would have to be analyzed, multiple medical records of multiple people who may not know that their records were being analyzed would have to be reviewed to determine whether this provider was habitually and without good cause breaking the law. And good cause is for, again, defined by Ledge Legal as a legally sufficient reason. So there would have to be a threshold beyond that reason that they were too busy or just didn't get around to it or forgot that one time. It would have to be a legally sufficient reason paired with that habituality. So it is written for those two to go hand in hand. So the nuts and bolts of the investigation would be predicated on one complaint from one person, and if there were no notes and it was just that one time, that could really only be defined by a true professional investigation, which would dig into other people's medical records perhaps without their knowledge. So I wanted to make sure that if it was of the interest in the committee that you got a picture of what the day-to-day would look like from that investigative standpoint.
So just to clarify, make sure that I understand, a single complaint could predicate an investigation, but action wouldn't necessarily be taken unless it met this fairly high threshold that we're describing in the legislation of habitual. So I think that's much more clear to me now. I appreciate that. Does anybody else have any questions for Ms. Chambers while we have her? All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Very much. Yeah. I did want to mention, too, that the question did come up, I think, from Representative Sullivan Leonard, that what's in place now, what's the expectation now, and the Medical Board and the Board of Nursing do have statutes and regulations that require patient education and informed consent. The Dental Board doesn't currently have them. The Board of Optometrists is working on their newly anointed prescriber role. And we are looking at this summer as being the first date in which patient education or provider education has been mandated by HB 159. So as many of the previous testifiers have said, we're looking for that culture to change with providers. But Medical Board and Nursing do already have those requirements.
I actually do want to just a small point of clarification there. Optometrists have actually had the authority to prescribe opiates for some time. There's not new law that enacted that. That was my legislation, and I want to be really clear. We didn't give them new authority. So
thank you. I appreciate that clarification.
It was a small oversight. Thank you for your testimony. And I'd like to recognize that Representative Keto has joined us. All right, is there anybody else in the room who wishes to testify on HB 268? All right, seeing none, is there any other questions that the committee has on the bill for now? All right, seeing none, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to close public testimony, and then we're going to set this bill aside and bring it back before the committee on Tuesday for final committee action at that time. On Tuesday, we're going to hear three bills. We're going to hear House Bill 313 dealing with the recovery of payment by insurance providers by Representative Jason Gren, HB 296 by Representative Matt Klayman covering marijuana use prevention programming, and also on Tuesday, as previously mentioned, we'll be looking to the will of the committee on House Bill 268. On Thursday of next week, we're going to hear House Bill 290 by the governor, which adds the Department of Health and Social Services Commissioner to the Criminal Justice Commission, and House Bill 336 by Minority Leader Millett on supportive decision-making agreements. We'll be taking public and invited testimony on both of those bills. And then finally, we'll hear a presentation from the Key Coalition. And now at 3:59, this hearing of the House Health and Social Services Committee is now adjourned.